Well, hey everyone, for this week's culture segment, we are very excited to have in studio with us Lisa Veldhaus. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Lisa, well, and I had to bring Martha back in the studio too. Martha, good to have you here.
Yes, I'm a bit of a fan of Lisa's.
Yes. Well, and that's good because they're going to have a little connection here that we'll tell you about in a second. But want you to know that Lisa also wrote a book called Craving Grace that we're going to be talking about here today. And because her now husband is maybe involved in this story a little bit as well, I just nabbed him too. And I said, hey, come on in.
Glad to be here in the morning too.
Nathan, great to have you here at the table. So very fun. You two are in the process of moving. You
it's
are
true.
Actually literally in transit across the country to,
yes.
Where are you going?
To Oceanside, California.
Okay.
I'll let you tell more, honey.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. I'm active duty Marine officer. I spent the last year in Quantico, and we're doing our pretty much every couple year move cross country. So we're in Quantico for last year and moving to Southern California, San Diego area.
Okay. So
Virginia to the West Coast.
Yeah.
And we can't wait for the sunshine.
So that,
yes.
Hopefully you will get some when
yes.
you make it there. That is very good. Well, and of course, we have to give Nathan props because he is a boundless listener and reader, has had some history with Boundless, so very excited about that.
Yeah.
Anyone who ever, you know, has anything positive to say about Boundless, we make you just give positive endorsements or whatever.
Well, it's a delight to be here this morning.
Very fun. All right, now Martha, I'll go ahead and let you make the connection with Lisa in your former life, so go ahead and do that.
Yes. Well, back in 2000, Lisa and I were both high school seniors.
It's true.
And we both entered a contest to be the 2000 Brio girl.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Ah, it's true. She won. I didn't.
Oh, my word.
But
do you need some tissues? We can go.
It makes for a good story. But what's cool is later on, I joined the staff of Brio and got to be a part of the picking process for future Brio girls. So
it
worked out in the end.
So do you think, looking back on it, did Lisa actually have the qualifications, or should you have gotten it?
Oh, my.
Oh, we won't go there.
Well, so that's good that now it's kind of come full circle, and here she is back
in the studio.
I guess
so.
And,
yeah.
We get the chance to interview her. Okay, so this is going to be fun because this book is, like, weird. I mean that in a good way. It is, like, wacky and wild. Like, from the time that I even just read the back cover, I was like, what? Where is she going to go with this? This is all crazy. It's, like, fasting, and it's relationships, and it's non-relationships, and it's a
true.
Former book that was read. And it's just, like, this crazy, crazy memoir, which is kind of funny because you're young.
I know.
But you've already had plenty to talk about.
Well, actually, one of the first things that my husband said when he heard I was writing a memoir was, are you kidding me? You're only 28 years old.
You were 27 at the time, honey.
Okay, well, that makes even worse. But yeah, it's a memoir about a 6-month period in my life when I fasted from sweets to try to learn that God could be sweet. And then it's about the 3 or so years that followed and how life changed as a result of the fast.
Yeah, very, very true. And there was just a lot of, in fact, as I was even telling Martha this on the front end, I was like, I can hardly even keep up going through this book with the many, many very intentional and very almost like unbelievable things that you did in this process. I mean, who picks this kind of thing and who plants themselves in this situation and who has this kind of relationship? And so it was really fascinating. And
Well, thank you.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was great. And actually the subtitle for it is A Story of Faith, Failure, and My Search for Sweetness, which I think plays out in a number of different ways throughout the book. But the one thing I want you to just kind of start out by talking about, Lisa, is how you open the book. And you open
sure.
with a scenario of being at post your sister's wedding.
Uh-huh.
And really it's a pivotal point between kind of who your former self was and this
right.
break that you made into this new experiential realization of, oh my goodness, I have just made a decision, a life decision, and what is this going to mean for me this point forward?
Sure. Well, it's kind of an awkward place to start a book, I'll admit that, because the story has to do with my first and second kisses. We talked a little bit with Martha about my history with Brio, but I have an additional history, and that is I wrote a book called Saving My First Kiss when I was in my late teens and early 20s, and did a lot of things related to that book, speaking and traveling around the country and writing, and it became a little bit of a, more than a little bit, it became the foundation for my career and some ministry opportunities, and everybody knew I was this person who wrote this book, and then I was vowing to save my first kiss until I was engaged. And I'll let you read the book for more as to why. But to make a long story short, I broke that vow in a way I would have never expected. And that kind of came on the tail end of this 6-month fast from sweets. And during that 6 months, I had been learning that I wasn't the good and faithful person that I had always thought I was. And so the first kiss was sort of a culmination of all of that, where I finally had to accept that I'm not a good person. I'm at my very basic level, I'm a sinner. And even the things that I try to do faithfully for the Lord, I can't do them perfectly. So the first kiss kind of is the story that starts it all out. And then I go backward from there and tell you everything that led up to it.
Yeah. And actually, you refer to, and this is where I think it's so funny. I mean, just to even be as young as you were at the time and to have this completely mapped out story for how this was all going to go down and how you were going to, you know, come hell or high water, you were going to grow in Christ. And you were, you know. And,
yeah.
So you basically embarked on, and this is part of the backup situation, what you called the Honey Project.
Yeah.
Which really was birthed out of some great intention and some great biblical teaching. So tell us a little bit about how that came about.
Sure. Well, I had heard one of my favorite Bible teachers speak about how God is sweet like honey. And this is a verse that I knew, and there are several verses in the Bible that allude to that. There's one that says, "Taste and see that the Lord is good." And when I heard this particular teaching, I was in the middle of the most disillusioned season that I've ever had. And I'd been faithful, or so I thought, for a really long time, and was kind of known as a role model in Christian circles. And I was not happy. And I blamed God for it and thought, here, I've been so faithful and I've tried to be good, and you have not given me the sort of life I wanted, not even close. And where is the blessing in all of this? So to hear that God was sweet like honey just did not compute for me. And I didn't like that. That didn't sit well with me, because I love the Lord and I'd been a part of his church all my life. And so I wanted to be able to believe that he was sweet like honey. So I was really at a point of desperation after all of that, and decided to fast from sweets to get a new understanding of sweetness, and maybe through that know God better and know that he could be sweet. But to be honest, I didn't expect anything to happen. I just thought, oh, I'll be disciplined and that will be good. And that's what Christians do. We're obedient. And through the obedience, I'll learn more about God. And that was not what happened at all. God showed up in amazing ways. And it was almost as if he put me in front of myself and said, you do not have to be this person that you've tried to be for so long, always obedient, always good, really earning standing with him. And he showed me that he had earned my standing with him, and that was enough and more than enough. So that's the basic story.
Yeah. Well, I think it was interesting how you drive back then to that that moment of the kisses. And, you know, you'd been doing well with the sweets, you know, and it was like, never did you think that you'd be kind of blindsided maybe by the circumstances at your sister's wedding. And I like how you say in the book, you say, two Mizla kisses, they uncovered that I was incapable of earning my way religiously, that I couldn't achieve or even want goodness, that my heart at its core was sinister and dark and confused.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was more where your heart was at the time. It's not that, oh, my goodness, I just made this irretrievable mistake that will now completely define me and there's no redemption in this and there's no whatever. But like you were kind of insinuating there, it uncovered maybe your heart at its core.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it was so little of it was about kissing. It was about, I had always set up my life to not fail, and everything was spiritual, and everything that I did was trying to please God. And I think I lived that way because I didn't understand that I already had his pleasure, and that in Christ I had standing with God. And so to fail this vow that I had made. It really wasn't all that much about kissing. It was just about failing. Mm-hmm. And for me, that was a big failure. And it was the first time that I had had to acknowledge that I can't do it on my own. I can't be good enough, no matter how hard I try.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think we have that tendency of having the standard and I can't make a mistake and I have to be perfect? And where did that come from for you?
Well, I think it's because I didn't understand what God's love is, that he loves me, and that is his, it all stems from his goodness, from his character. It has nothing to do with mine. My character can be a response to his love, but my character can't bring it on. He just loves me, and he has given all of himself for me. And when I came to understand that, really, I came to understand it because I had come to the end of myself. I saw that my ability wasn't enough. I wasn't as capable or as spiritual as I had always thought. And then all I had left were the promises that I had known since what seemed like forever from the Bible, that God is love, that we can't earn our place with him, that we don't need to try. And that was incredible good news for someone who had been in the church for a long time and supposedly knew the gospel. I met it face to face after a long time of trying to get there on my own, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting how, you know, throughout the book, it's evident that you don't really do anything halfway. I mean, it was like every situation was like, okay, I mean, you became part of this farm.
It's true.
I mean, it was like first you were kind of, you know, a little bit reconciled to the fact that you were living in a small town, but maybe you weren't quite satisfied with that because should you have more? And but you still had good relationships and you still had this great job and were fulfilled in that. But then, you know, then came the farm and then came this whole experience of the relationships through that and the dating and the online stuff.
Oh my goodness.
And I mean, what was going through your head through these experiences? Because we kind of, even though we know that we're supposed to trust God and he's sovereign, we still are living life on this timeline of expecting certain things to happen at certain times. And so how did you reconcile all of that?
Well, I think it was a little easy because I had no expectations. Mm-hmm. And I'll say that my life in real life is not as exciting as this book might make it seem. I mean, those 6 months and then the immediate time following, I felt like God just poured things on and poured like honey. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because I'm just really thick-skulled and he needed to pound it into me that this is not an accident. These things are happening because I'm choosing to speak to you right now. And so I just kind of tried to roll with it as best as I could and learned a lot in the process and was humbled a lot in the process. And you'll read that in the book over and over, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it is. I mean, it's just so funnily written. I mean, it's just, I mean, as I was reading it, I was like, oh my word, this is like, I have lived this. There are some elements here that I have lived. And it feels very, especially for the women out there, I think they will very much resonate with what you have to say. So I want to fast forward then and talk about the portion of the book where you come to this realization, and it's through experientially through food, mm-hmm. where you start realizing some of your cravings changing. And then you draw that in parallel to ultimately your cravings for God and your experience of God. And how, just talk a little bit about how that process unfolded and how really that was transformational for you.
Sure. Well, I talk in the book about what I call a cheap, sweet counterfeit. And I think that's true. That was true of me, of my taste physically, and it was also true of my taste spiritually, that I have always been a sweet tooth and became quite committed to chocolate and dessert and all things decadent. And then when I fasted from sweets, I only allowed myself fruit and fruit juice and honey for sweets. And it was terrible. And I thought that I would do okay, but it took 2 months for me to even start successfully. I kept failing and failing. And then even when I did manage to hold on for 6 months without sweets, it was really, really difficult. And that started keying me into the idea that maybe I'm not as strong as I thought, because here I can't get even my body to be in line with what my head and heart want. So that was sort of the physical line of the book. But then the spiritual parallel is that I know I should want God, that true sweetness, like the honey, the fruit juice. I know that I should want him, but what I'm finding is that in so many areas of my life, I satisfy my cravings with things that are the cheap counterfeit, like wanting approval, wanting a successful career, wanting a relationship. And it's not bad to want any of those things, but when they become the ultimate thing, then everything is off. And then the taste is leading us in the wrong direction. So
yeah,
I guess I learned to recalibrate.
Yeah.
And God showed me what real sweetness is, and that's him.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's interesting because really with the books you've written, I mean, the two books are very different stories of who you are, very different pictures. And, you know, I think the overarching theme, which obviously is coming through in this book, is that of grace and that of recognizing really what grace can do. And just one other portion of the book that I want to read quickly is where you finish off one of the final chapters by saying, "This is the scandal of grace. The jolt that comes afterward is not from the heaviness of remorse, but from a new tender lightness. I was learning how to be less and infinitely lower than I'd always expected and thought I was. I was beginning to see what it means to be drawn to God, not committed out of mere duty, not faithful simply because it might cajole him into favor, but attracted to him and won over by the reckless extent of his love," which is a huge paradigm shift from I'm going to do X, Y, Z, and this is going to catapult me into some level of, you know, spiritual fervor or something along those lines.
Yeah. And I think that for me, the most surprising thing and the most beautiful thing in my journey thus far and the journey of this book, Craving Grace, is to see the freedom that we have in Christ. I didn't have freedom in Christ until I discovered grace, until he showed me his grace, because it was so much about rules and so much about obedience. And there's nothing wrong with those things, but they should come out of joy. And when they come out of joy, there is this sense of lightness. Mm-hmm. It's not a burden. It's a delight to follow. And that's been an incredible and really fun shifts to be able to make.
Yeah. All right. Well, Nathan, you have to jump in here because you have now become you've become part of this story. And so much of what Lisa, you know, has learned on the front end and not only walked with the Lord in, but just, you know, grappled with and stuff was part of her story as a single woman. But now as a married couple, you have the opportunity to apply and flesh this out further. I mean, did you meet her and say, "Can I even take this on?" I don't know. I mean, what did that look like when you saw kind of some of her story unfold?
That's a great question, because actually, when I met her, she was still in the process of writing the book. Mm-hmm. And you were in the process actually of finishing proposals and looking to see how what would happen in your future. Actually, the first, maybe real quickly, how we met was pretty maybe not standard. She met the church. She went to visit family members who went to the same church. And because it was a long-distance relationship and I was deploying very soon, almost the vast majority of our time had been long-distance and email and phone calls.
Mm-hmm.
And so we talked a lot by email and conversation about how God worked in our life, how grace had been an impact. And I guess there's something you said when you're reading it in emails as opposed to seeing it in person. So I almost like got to know her through emails in the first place. It's almost like reading a book email by email through the whole process.
Mm-hmm.
It was really neat to see early on how much God had worked in her life, how he had taught her about grace. And that was one of the things that really attracted me to her early on. It was maybe like a week into the relationship or so.
We moved fast.
Very quickly.
Over email.
So it was always neat and interesting to see how God had worked in her life, and also to kind of be a part of encouraging her from a distance. And it's very different, I guess, because it was long distance to begin with, seeing encouraging her from a distance than being married, always seeing each other and day by day trying to encourage and deal with each other's lives. And also realizing we're not as perfect as we would like to think we are. mm-hmm. It's amazing how marriage does that constantly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's big.
Yeah, marriage has been an interesting picture of grace. And You know, I was single, like completely single until 28 and then married at 29. And so I, you know, I'd lived the single life for a while, and it annoyed me when people compared Christianity to marriage because they were always married when they did that. And I thought, come on, like, it's really not that close. And it's certainly not a dead ringer for God's grace. But yeah, having somebody see you at your ugliest all the time and put up with you, and not only that, but love you and encourage you and serve you, it kind of forces something to click, and you think, this is what love is. It's not this, you know, that initial crazy attraction, or, you know, that's certainly part of it. But the seasoned love is when you can serve someone else, and you can allow yourself to be served by someone else, mm-hmm. and let them really see the worst of you and the best of you.
And also to realize yourself how sinful you are. I think one of the most striking things about marriage, you read this on Balance all the time, but realize how selfish and self-centered you are until you've got somebody else who's you're living with. And I'm told kids is part two, sanctification, and teenagers part three, and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But just being married and constantly realizing that I want to think about myself more than I want to think about my wife, mm-hmm. It is convicting, and it's a draw to repentance constantly.
Mm-hmm. Was there anything, Nathan, that you had read or learned from Boundless that helped you apply that towards your relationships with her, both being long distance initially and then saying, okay, this is something that I think really we can make work?
Definitely a long distance. I know I'm trying to recall back to two, three years ago that was happening. I know Boundless does has had a number of articles, and I wish I was familiar enough to quote the articles on the date, but a number of articles about long distance relationships and ways to do that. And yeah. I definitely think also that the courtship model, or however the Boundless writes a lot about involving parents and just wise ways about pursuing a relationship, definitely was very influential in how we've tried to pursue the relationship as well. I Balance writes a lot about relationships, and it was at that time in my life, it was very helpful for kind of forming how I think and thinking through a biblical way of how do we pursue a relationship in a godly way.
Yeah. Yeah, Lisa, you better be appreciative of that, because you could still be dating. If
you had not Thank you, Boundless.
Yeah. Be like, it is now 7 years into our relationship, and we are still doing pizza on Friday nights. So yeah, we discourage that as much as possible. Yeah. But
good to hear the good testimonies.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
And to see that, you know, you make that commitment, and like you said, I mean, you're now moving across country. I mean, there are different things. Life will change, schedules will change, things, you know, your circumstances will change and stuff, but there's just a great deal to apply of grace in that situation as it plays out.
I mean,
that's big.
And certainly, you know, marriage isn't the only place where you learn this. I talk in the book about how, you mentioned the farm, how I became part of a small community of people. It sounds like a commune, but that's not what it was. People who decided to care about each other and live in the same general area. And we learned a lot more about each other than I think we would have ever thought we would have learned. And we saw the good, the bad, and the ugly. And that, too, was such a lesson in loving others and learning to be loved and showing the bad to others. I think so often we're afraid to let people see our own sin, and when we do, it's an opportunity for grace to hit us once again, and that's just an incredible thing every time.
Mm-hmm. Lisa, for someone who's listening and might be thinking, wow, I want to learn that, like, it sounds like her life has really changed through that. What would your advice be to start that journey?
Well, really, the best advice that I can give is to ask the Lord to prove His grace and His sweetness to you. That's really all I did. And I fasted, but, you know, as I said, not very well. And it was God's showing up in my life that made the story. There wouldn't be a story had He not proved Himself to me in the ways that He did over and over and over. There are so many stories in the book where I found that I was full of sin, and He was still right there in the middle of it, showing Himself to me and loving me. And He can do that with anybody. You just have to be open to it and looking for it. And as He opens our hearts, we can see Him more clearly, I think.
Well, I just think it's a cool story, and one that is born out of a lot of where many Boundless listeners are right now, especially the women, you know, just wondering, what is God's purpose in this for me? And feeling very frantic in, should I do this? Should I do this? What does this look like? And, you know, we're all under a burden of task and legalism and expectation and duty and stuff like that. And to really recognize and learn from your experience and realize, you know, what God brought to you in the midst of that, and that he is very willing to show himself to those that ask. And I think that's big, both for you as a woman in your single years, and now that you two are married, I think it's huge.
Phase that's one awesome. was the book, and now we're living phase two, I think.
There you go. Well, maybe there will be another book out of that one at some point.
We'll see
how that plays out. Well, again, the book is Craving Grace, A Story of Faith Failure and My Search for Sweetness. The author is Lisa Velthaus. Find out more about Lisa at Lisa Velthaus. House, that's VELTHouse.com. She's blogging.
That's
she's got
right.
some thoughts that she's sharing as the book has released now, and just moving into this new phase of life. So you can keep up with her there. And Nathan, thanks so much for being part of the conversation as well. And thank you for serving our country, and all the best to you both as you move into this next chapter. That's exciting. So hopefully we'll see you.
Well, thank you very much.
If there's another cross-country trip, you'll come by on the
we'll stop by.
The backside and stop by, and maybe we'll have sunnier weather for you. So thanks
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.